Hey, good morning and good afternoon, wherever you are. Welcome to another episode of Cyber Confidential with Jill Sullivan, Vitaly, and me. And Jim is still missing in action. Soon he'll be back. And today we have Chris Weisselbull and Fergus Hay as our guests. Maybe Fergus, you introduce yourself and Chris.
Great, Chris, do you want to go first?
Sure. So I'm Chris Weisselbull. I've been in the security community since the late 90s when I was in a hacking group called The Loft. And since then, I've been a consultant at Stake. And then since 2006, I've been the founder and former CTO of Veracode. And now I'm our chief security evangelist. So I'm happy to be out here evangelizing cybersecurity things.
Very cool. And hi, everyone. So I'm Fergus Hay. I'm the co-founder and CEO of The Hacking Games. I have zero credibility here because I'm not from cyber. I'm not technical. My only credibility is that I'm a parent riveted by parental paranoia on what's happening to my kids and the rest of my kids' generation. And Chris has very kindly been on our board since we began 18 months ago. He's been a great supporter, mentor, coach, and enlightener to me of the technical side of cyber. And Chengti, thank you so much for inviting us to come today and share a bit about our mission and what we're trying to do to create a generation of ethical hackers to make the world safer.
Yeah, when I told Vitaly and Joe and Jim about what you guys are doing, they were very interested. You know, as CISOs, they see this as a pipeline of talent and also see how the work they're doing can be sort of permeated to the next generation, right? Maybe you guys talk a little bit about Hacking Games and what the company does.
Sure. I'm happy to give you the short version of it. So our vision is to create a generation of ethical hackers to make the world safer. And the reason why we're doing that are for reasons you guys are super familiar with. The data shows that by 2027, the world will lose $24 trillion in a single year to cybercrime. There's some debate around that number, but if you take it as a direction of travel, that's the GDP of the United States pre-tariffs. That was also twice the cost of COVID globally, according to the IMF. So if it was a nation, it would be the third largest economy in the world. Now, to a layperson like me, it's an unfathomable number. But I was really interested in who are the bad guys. And of course, nation states that are well documented and organized cyber gangs out of Eastern Europe and South Asia and South America and Africa. That's all well documented. But what I was blown away by was the data that showed that the vast majority of the people committing the hacking are children. In fact, data out of Europol that was published last year, of the 14,000 teenagers they interviewed across Europe and the UK, showed that 69% of them have committed a cybercrime. 69%. And the US, Tuffin published some data that showed 8 out of 10 of New York teenagers polled have hacked someone by the age of 16. So I was really blown away by that. And what I learned from our law enforcement partners, who are the likes of the FBI and the National Crime Agency and Europol and Interpol, is that the profile of hackers has changed. And this group of people's generation of hackers were brilliantly smart, often on the outside of the kind of mainstream culture, and they found their tribes online. But this new generation are a bit different. It's now middle of the curve kids, 69%, 8 out of 10. And the barrier to entry is now zero into hacking. You used to have to be incredibly smart. Chris has regaled me on his stories of what happened at Loft and how you got these brilliantly smart, unconventional minds to crack the impossible. Unfortunately, now for the kids, the barrier to entry is super low. You know, Google will give you the tools and YouTube will train you and you'll find your tribe on the Discord. You'll get inspired by the gangs on TikTok. And the pathway is really quick. And the entry point is gaming. In fact, you know, 79.5 million kids a day are playing Roblox. And of course, what they're doing is looking for cheat codes and mods, and they're trying to find how they can break the system and find exploits and cheat the game. That's human nature and creativity. And that in itself is commendable. That's human experimentation. But what we've learned from our partners at Europol and the FBI is that the organized cyber gangs are watching the kids on the gaming platforms. And when they see kids as young as my son, Raphael, at the age of 11 years old, when they see them repeatedly using cheat codes or running exploits or modding, they approach the kids, masquerading as another kid, and they offer them an incentive. Hey, do you want to earn 100 Robux? Do you want to earn some crypto? Come on over to this Discord and we'll put you in a squad and we'll give you the tools and we'll put you to work. And this kind of Fagin-style grooming is happening at a really, really mass scale. And that really shocked us and shocked me as a parent. And it made me feel like this Generation Z, is at an ethical fork in the road. They're either going to be a liability to society, but they could be an asset. And what the research and the guidance from law enforcement has helped us understand is if you present them with a legitimate pathway to make money, if you can mentor them, if you can provide them with training pathways and then career pathways into the security industry, the vast majority are happy to take it. So that's where we felt that there was a kind of powerful social opportunity. And then we looked at the industry. And this is where we learned that there are 5.5 million people working in cyber globally, but there are 4.8 million unfilled jobs. That enormous labor deficit is forecasted to grow over time. And we just felt like, wow, we've got this interesting duality here. On the one side, you've got an industry who are really looking for unconventional talent, the next wave of hackers who can think in a different way, who've got that gaming mindset to solve really challenging problems. And on the other hand, we've got an entire generation who are like a petri dish of exploits and pushing their gaming mindsets and learning the basics of cyber in the gaming world. But these two aren't connecting. And that's what we felt is the problem that we could solve. And that's the mission that we're on in two ways. Firstly, we're creating an evaluation platform called Haptai that evaluates the aptitude of this young generation, not based on their skills and performance on LinkedIn or in certificate grabbing, but in gaming, understanding their gaming mindsets and their psychography as neurodivergent talent to build an aptitude profile of them. So the likes of Joe and Vitaly can identify and evaluate this unconventional talent, and then identify where they can fit in the cybersecurity workforce, which is seemingly got a big need. And that's our mission, is to create a generation of ethical hackers, narrow the gap between this Gen Z gaming, unconventional mindset generation and the labor deficit that seems to exist in the cybersecurity world globally.
I'll just jump right in because I just love the way you're describing it, because, and you know, for those of us who have been dealing with cybersecurity since the 90s, since the 90s, the people I've been hiring onto my teams and the people I've been running into as we've been investigating the attacks on our services have always been young people. Like half the people I've hired, I think, have told me, oh, I'm just lucky that I didn't get in trouble when I was a teenager. Why I'm able to have this career. And some say I got in trouble as a teenager and I still have this career. But so like we've seen that since forever in cybersecurity, that young people are facing this crossroads of like experimentation, gaming. I mean, like when I joined Facebook, my whole security team, it seemed like stayed up playing StarCraft all night, every night. And so like the thing that's different, is this generation is different. And that resonates so much with me because as someone who's run large teams over the last few years, like just in general, we talk about how do we meet Gen Z where they are in the workplace. And to think about it in the context of responsible disclosure and bug bounty programs and all the tooling and structure that we've built over the last 20 years to try and meet those people, like we've got to go even further. So this is super cool.
Well, Joe, it's so great to hear that. And particularly because, you know, you guys are running the big organizations, you know, who will make the biggest difference. I think what I've learned in this journey is... I think the industry has evaluated a different set of criteria that is relevant to this generation. You know, we did a really interesting interview with Jeff Mann. He's the guy who created the red team for the NSA. And I said to Jeff, God, you know, it must be so technical and you must be really looking for the best engineers. And he said, no, like we're looking for puzzle solvers. You know, and when he was a kid, he got into cryptography because his dad had wooden and metal puzzles like Rubik's cubes in the living room. And that was the mindset. And that's what helped us understand, wow, actually the correlation between gamers and hackers, to your point, Joe, is like 100%. Like every hacker has a gaming mindset.
It is 100% because it's exploration and it's puzzle solving. But there's another third component, which is like power over others. Like you get power and you can do things that other people can't do in the game. You get that bigger weapon, right? And it's like you have better tools, you have better exploits. And the parallels are just incredible. And you can see how you can seamlessly go from that, you know, virtual world of exploration, puzzle solving, and gaining power to one which is a different virtual world where there's, instead of in-game items, it's real money, right? And the savviness of them to be able to do the types of, like you're saying, like, they're not actually that technically amazing. Like, they're not building their own tools. I don't think Scattered Spider even built any of their own tools. It's all off-the-shelf tools, but they're really savvy to come up with things like MFA fatigue and finding people's social media profiles on Discord and things like that, and using that data. You know, with a lot of this is just social engineering attacks, but it's the kind of stuff that you learn in these gaming worlds because you're working with other people, you're tricking other people, you're getting one over on them. It's just, it's almost weird. Like our worlds are like melding, gaming and cybersecurity.
You actually mentioned that one of the biggest challenges we have in terms of pipeline creation, new talent coming in, right? So if you look at the standard ways for us to recruit new talent, usually look at the schools, but if we look at the exits and we look at the programs, like cybersecurity programs, even at top universities, they're not teaching them the right skills, right? They're going to get the basic technical skills in place, risk management, certification, but it actually doesn't translate into almost any real tools on a job, right? So what you have is kind of unique because not only it teaches problem solving, it gets people excited, but you take a kind of unique approach to how do you create that pipeline for a lot of leaders in cybersecurity to start tapping into at some point. Because as an industry, we still struggle with this problem hugely.
I can remember when I was hiring people to be on our research team or our pen testing team, there was always a huge value that was given to work done outside of the normal academic or boot camp. Because like everyone has that, right? Like you kind of have to have that. You have to have that certification or whatever, that degree. But it's the work that's done outside that shows the creativity and the exploration. And like you'll pick up a tool that no one else has ever picked up before and use it for a certain way. And I always put a huge value on that, but it was rare. And I see what the Hacking Games is doing is potentially diverting more of that rare talent into the normal pipeline.
So Chris, how did you meet Fergus and how did you guys start working together?
I actually met Fergus through Don Dia, who is a cybersecurity entrepreneur, who's one of the members of the board. I guess he's a co-founder also of the Hacking Games. And so he was involved with Outpost 24, which is a pen testing firm and more in Europe. Don knew me and introduced me. And it was really because the Hacking Games was looking for people who had come from the non-traditional side of cybersecurity, actually come from the, you know, I call myself a hacker hobbyist, right? I wasn't getting paid to do vulnerability research, right? And it's like people who came from that side of the world to come over to become traditional cybersecurity professionals. What is that transition like? How can you understand both sides of that transition? And they wanted people who had gone through this. Another example was, I know they Fergus and Don reached out to Marcus Hutchins, who is, you know, famously the guy who stopped WannaCry, but then was also prosecuted for some of the tools he was building that could be used, to commit cybercrime. So, people who understand the draw of sort of both sides and then chose to go the legit way can help the Hacking Games understand how do we help with this fork in the road.
And I've got to say, it was, again, as an outsider, I think one of the most powerful things within the cyber community is the sense of mission amongst the hackers. So completely by accident, we now have 400 of kind of highly regarded ethical hackers in our Virtue community, of which Marcus is one, and Chris is one, and Jeff Mann, and many others. And what unifies everyone is a sense of awareness of how vulnerable young people are to being manipulated by the bad guys. And there's this kind of ethic inside the community to say, hey, Hacking Games, I don't know if you've got it all right here. Like, I don't know if we have all the answers yet, but like, you're trying to do the right thing and we want to help you. And that sense of community has been, it's an incredible spirit that I've never seen in any other industry. And, you know, we're fortunate to be kind of benefactors of it. But I think it's a really fundamental part of making the world a bit safer.
Fergus, could I ask a question? Like, what have you learned about this generation and in terms of like, that would surprise us, old people?
Yeah, I mean, you will be pretty intimate with it, Joe, already. But we've now spent the best part of 2 years with what we call Gen Z, so age 12 to 27. That ranges from kids at the age of 15 who have been making $20,000 to $30,000 a month. Ranges from people like Danny Kelly and Marcus who have been prosecuted and convicted of crime. It also includes actually some really incredible savants like Marco Liberale, who's 13 years old, keynoted at Black Hat last year and the year before. Is teaching at the King Abdullah Science and Technology Universities to computer science graduates at 13. So we've really seen a plethora of talent. And I would kind of break down the insights into kind of five buckets. The first thing is that the levels of neurodivergence is really, really high. So EY published a report to say that 12 to 14% of the IT industry in America is self-identified neurodivergent. 50% of the cybersecurity industry is self-identified as neurodivergent. And amongst the younger generation, it's not seen as a handicap, it's seen as an asset. So I would say the levels of neurodivergence amongst this generation are extremely high. And we can introduce lots of research that shows why this is the perfect era for them. But it's important to understand the context.
Fergus, is this rate of neurodivergence higher than previous generation?
I'm not qualified to answer that, Chengxi, but I will say is the rate of disclosure is higher. The rate of disclosure is higher. So, you know, I'm not sure, but it is a really important factor. And part of our model, our evaluation model, evaluates their levels of neurodivergence and psychographics, which is a psychographic model we've built out of Oxford with Professor Mark Loftus. So, so first of all, neurodivergence, super important. Secondly, very interestingly, lots of this generation were bullied at school. They didn't quite fit the social codes of quarterbacks and cheerleaders, and so they were kind of picked on. And what that's created is a sense of vengeance, a sense of a disgust of people trying to manipulate others. And that spirit is pretty strong. So when there's a bad guy doing bad things to good people, they're pretty motivated to stop that. I think that is a really powerful, unique mindset I've just not seen, maybe outside of the military services or the police forces. I think that's something to be captivated on. The third things are more practical, but they're true of this generation. You know, this generation have grown up being rewarded instantly in their gaming behaviors. So what they see is, I do this, I get a reward immediately. And that reward has actually had financial value to it because you can trade in your XP points for upgrades. So they are way more commercial than any other generation. So I would say these are the things that motivate them. Fame, you know, they feel frustrated that their intellect and capabilities have not been recognized and they've been in the shadows too long. Secondarily, financial reward. They see at one level, they're used to being rewarded in games. They want to be rewarded for their skill sets. That starts at a really young age, by the way. Research shows from about 11. Third to that is they get frustrated that these idiotic influencers on Instagram and YouTube are making a ton of money. And they're sitting there going, but I'm really bright. I want to get paid like that. So they want fame. They really want fame. And they're highly competitive. I mean, ferociously competitive. They want to be on top of the leaderboard. They're used to gaming leaderboards and they want to be seen as the best. And what that all aggregates into, Joe, is that this generation, they believe their time is now and they are desperate to use their hobby skills professionally, but they are so frustrated in the industry, and Vitaly was touching on this, that they aren't identified, evaluated, or given a pathway to use their services for legitimate. And that is a big opportunity for us.
Yeah, I think tapping into that, the desire to, if they see some bad actors out there, to thwart them is a great thing that we can tap into. My son is a Gen Z, he's 16, and he got involved in scam baiting because he the idea that, you know, these scammers were taking advantage of elderly people and getting them to give access to their bank accounts. When he found out about this, he just got upset about it, right? And someone has gamified this, right, with scam baiting, where you can be on a leaderboard. And basically, what you do is you call the scammers and you keep them on the line for as long as you can. And you tie up all their time and you get points for how many minutes you get. And there's a leaderboard. You go through this VoIP network to do it. And for a while, and he was doing this when he was like 13, and he's got YouTubes of this, and he even had one of the scammers crying on the phone. He was like, "Man, why do you do this? You're taking advantage of old people." And he's like, "It's my only job." And you know, I think we can really tap into that. I'm kind of excited about the vein of this.
Pretty interesting. Fergus and Chris, you work with Gen Z. Today's young people, young hackers, do you observe a different moral code for this generation than older people like us?
Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I do think it is a little bit more fluid. I do think it is more cultural moral code than, you know, I think in the past it's been more religious morals or more like the government legal system. I do believe it is a little bit more fluid. There is a right and wrong, but it doesn't seem to come from institutions. It seems to come from the culture more.
My observation, I'm not as qualified as Chris on this, but just from the outside, you know, there's a social contract in life. You know, take my son, Rafa, who's 11 years old. He always gets picked on. So I bet, as in, I always use him as the example. But, you know, Rafa knows from my wife and I that he can't go to school, punch a kid in the face and steal their money. Right. That's then like reasserted by the village, you know, the neighbors, the school teachers, his classmates. And then it's enforced by government and law enforcement, then the rules. But, you know, when these kids are growing up in the digital world now, and not one of those three pillars of society are functioning properly. Like, parents are completely unaware of what their kids are doing on gaming platforms in particular. Secondarily, the online community, they're not stopping each other. They're kind of encouraging each other, you know. And then thirdly, the government and law enforcement just are not resourced to enforce online. And so the kids are like free-range chickens, you know. They're just like out there, you know, just vulnerable. And so I think no one is guiding their moral code in the way that when I was a kid, my parents would say, when you go to the playground, don't go and talk to the drug dealer in the hoodie and don't get in the car with a middle-aged white man with the puppies, right? There was that stranger danger guidance. The people are just not equipped. The parents are not equipped to pass that moral guidance onto the kids in the digital space. So there's one thing which is like, we haven't transitioned the social contract to be applicable to the modern world. And then the second thing is, it's a bit unclear of whether cheating in gaming is cool, bad, illegal, or to be encouraged. And, you know, we've just published a white paper yesterday, which I'm happy to send to you, Joe and Vitaly, that basically shows that the cheating and modding behavior in gaming should be encouraged because it's creativity and exploitation design, and it can translate into cybersecurity skill sets. But at what point do you say until it starts stealing money and damaging others? And I think it's a bit blurred. And I don't think there's clarity on that. And you know, we probably need to get to clarity on that.
The cheating stuff is fascinating because it really just is a security control, right? And bypassing security controls is what the red team does and what offensive does. And these kids are learning about like DLL injection through and basically antivirus pattern detection and behavior detection through figuring out cheating. It's fascinating to me. We definitely didn't have this when I was when I was a hacker hobbyist.
So zooming out a little bit, for those of us who are like building security teams and things like that, and like, are there practical things we should be thinking about in terms of how to give these young people, like, help them know that this path exists? Are we writing our job descriptions the wrong way? Do we need to rethink like the list of things that we're looking for in candidates? Like I remember one time a long time ago, I was on a stage with two generals, and we were in front of a bunch of college students, and somebody raised their hand and said, what do you want to see on our resume to hire us? And the generals went first and I went last. And what they said was completely different from what I said, because I was hiring for a tech company, and I said, I want to see your GitHub and I want to see your HackerOne and BugCrowd. And they were talking about certifications. But like, what's the right modern answer if I'm up on that stage to that question, to this audience of teenagers?
Chris, do you want to go first?
I think it really is more unconventional, right? And it isn't necessarily like building software. Like, a lot of these attackers don't build anything. They figure out how to use the ecosystem that's out there to their advantage, the Discords and the social media profiles, and they understand how to use the tools that are available to them, whether they're, you know, cheat engines, or they are, you know, malware kits that they can download. It's assembling. How do you look at the environment, and how can you explore that environment and sort of solve the puzzle of gaining entry? And one of the challenging things is, and this is both a benefit and a challenge, a lot of these attacks that these younger groups like Lapsus and Scattered Spider are doing definitely cross over through organizations, and they're not easy to simulate, like, legally, right? Like, a lot of it is bribing people, right? Or the SIM swapping and stuff like that. And so I think it's like, it needs to be tabletopped, right? It's like, how can you get these minds, how can you figure out if this is a mind that can work on a tabletop team as the adversary, or work on a threat modeling team to build people building an identity system about how they would exploit this? These are some of the weakest parts of our ecosystem. Some of the weakest parts is what they're taking advantage of. And I don't see sort of the people that have CISSPs and people who have, you know, 15 years of experience really being able to solve some of these problems. But I think that some of these kids can. So I don't know exactly what the aptitude test is, but what we're trying to do at Hacking Games is take a lot of these different signals and pull them together in a model to make sense out of it, because I don't think there is one thing.
Go ahead, Fergus. Go ahead.
No, Vitaly, please.
I have a follow-up question, maybe a little different, which is, so you're testing people looking for this aptitude, you asking them to hone their skills, but that notion of social contract that Fergus was talking about doesn't exist in the digital world today to some degree, right? It's a very different version of social contract, right? And a lot of skills they develop, special on social engineering, etc., might be applicable to red teams or tabletops, but in the corporate world, right, it's a little more problematic. So how does a Hacking Game help us breach some of those social norms, if we can define them that way, right, in our world, from the digital world? Do you do something there to help, or is it purely focus on the skills and aptitude testing?
Yeah, it's a great question, Vitaly. So Hapti is the name of our evaluation platform, and it's the Hacking Aptitude platform. And we take two inputs. We take performance, and we take that by, we've evaluated 70 games online, such as EVE or World of Warcraft or League of Legends. And we take their performance in those games, and we've correlated how each one of those games correlates to a problem-solving, modding, hacking, cheating mindset. And then it correlates to different roles in the industry. And then we take their performance in CTFs and bug bounties and lockpicking, and chess, actually, is a brilliant piece. That's all the performance bit. But then we've developed this psychographic model called Jaya. And then what that does is evaluate, first of all, the levels of neurodivergence. It also evaluates their appetites for risk. It evaluates their decision making, and that gives you a whole picture. Now, the reason why we do that is to exactly your point, which is you can be highly skilled, but you may have questionable judgment. Or you could be a 19-year-old Joe who's incredibly talented, but is not suited to work 9 to 5 in a corporate environment, in a desk, wearing a gilet and some chinos and some Allbirds sneakers, right? And actually, the whole point of the psychographic profile is to say, take a 19-year-old Joe, he's really well-suited to work on a 6-week, highly intense, incident response case, because for the next 2 months, he's going to go to the beach in Bali and chill out. So use him, on site really intensely, and then on the beach for a while. So you can only do that if you understand it. Yeah, exactly. You can only do that if you understand the psychographic profile. So I don't think what we're trying to do is get this unconventional talent to conform to conventional workspaces. I think what we're trying to do is get companies to understand the unconventional talent and put together the right context and environment for them to perform at their best. And unfortunately, the churn rate that is so high in the industry, yes, there's the mental health pressure and the stress, but there's also that you've got neurodivergent people being asked to work in neurotypical environments. And that's what causes a lot of conflict. And if you can understand that, you can cater to the right environment for it.
So, Fergus, in your platform, you've got these talents who are unconventional, and you have them evaluated, right? And on the other end, you have like opportunities, I guess. Mm. You go to people like Vitaly and Joe and say, hey, what do you have in terms of job openings as well as maybe projects? Yeah?
That's right.
So
I must say, I thought the demand side was going to be a real headache. How do we get companies to want to get this unconventional talent? We actually interviewed 100 CISOs, CEOs, and government officials to say, if we deliver this product, would you be willing to use it and pay for it? And we're really happy that we've got partnerships with Amazon, Google, Microsoft. We've got KPMG. We have big retailers in the UK. We're working now with the Ministry of Defence in the UK, as well as the Department of Science, Innovation and Technology. So the government and the big tech companies and the cybersecurity companies like Veracode, like Sophos, have all lent in, and for different reasons. The big tech companies need the talent. The red teaming orientated companies really want the elite level talent. The governments want citizens to eschew the bad stuff and be an asset, not a liability. And interestingly, the armed forces were the ones who came on first. In General Coppinger Sims, who runs our cyber warfare division in the UK, in his own words, is he needs to recruit hackers, not infantry people who do press-ups in puddles. So the shape of the talent need has changed. So actually, I have way more demand than there is identification and supply of the talent, which is why we're building Haptai to get them in.
It's really interesting. It's like you're building an 8200 for like different countries.
Well, let's see. I mean, 8200, they've got their own environment going on there in as well. But no, look, I think if we do our job properly, we are going to harness the very best unconventional talent from Gen Z. But one of the challenges, how do we inspire them to want to do it? And unfortunately, the cyber industry, as an outsider, I think has done a really appalling job of communicating to the wider world. I think it's kind of lived in the shadows almost delightfully. But the issue is now in the mass, and just open up your news media every day and there's a big global hack that is affecting everyone. But when you look at the industry, there's only one image of a hacker. It's the hoodie up, it's no face, it's the matrix in the background tapping away at a keyboard. I mean, I was at JISEC conference in Dubai with you, Chengzi, and that was the imagery everywhere. And I was thinking, well, let's play it out. So what do kids think is a hacker? Just the bad guy. They just think it's the bad guy. When I grew up, it was like Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman and She-Ra. We had heroic figures to aspire to, but we've only presented the bad, the criminal figure of a hacker. But the real ethical hackers are people like Tim Berners-Lee and Nigel Shadbolt, who created the World Wide Web, or Steve Jobs, who got paid by companies to hack their phone lines in order to get the seed capital for Apple. Bill Gates, who got banned from using phones and computers for a year when he was 12 because he was freaking. But we don't present this kind of heroic ethical hacker image, which generations could look up to and go, I want to be like that. And so that's, you know, a core part of what we're trying to do is speak to this generation in their language, in popular culture, using content, media, influencers to say, hey, ethical hackers are cool. They're heroic. You can make a ton of money and you can be the rock stars of this era rather than just the creepy hoodie criminal, which is the only image that's in the industry.
So kind of let me throw a counterpoint at you from like the CISO perspective, just to be devil's advocate. I've built teams that have a lot of people who had that hacker mindset, and because I loved working with them and I saw them as problem solvers. But the challenge I had with those teams was that 90% of the work that I need done is far from glamorous. It's like I was talking about this with the CISO yesterday. It's always about the basics. I need somebody who wants to go sit and go through all the settings on all my SaaS apps, you know, and like study them and understand, like, because they're not the same. I appreciate the cool side of this, I think, is that I want the person doing that work to think about like what some companies have popularized lately, but like, is that like, it's the stringing together of problems that causes the quote toxic combination. And it's that mindset that will find those toxic combinations. But it's not all glorious. Like I found the bad guy. It's a lot of grinding through things in cybersecurity. And I see Vitaly nodding his head because that like we spend a lot of time trying to get, we look in our team, 90% are trying to do cool stuff and innovative stuff. And I'm like, I want 90% doing the grunt work. I hate to say it. I mean, maybe AI will magically replace the grunt work and take over that for my team next week, but like I keep waiting for that and it hasn't happened.
Chris, what do you think?
No, I mean, a lot, most of life is the grunt work, right? Like I mean, this is one way I, you know, talk to my son is like, you know, that's that star, you know, soccer player, they had to kick thousands upon thousands upon thousands of balls day after day after day after day to become really good at to be really good at something. So I think part of it is just like the incentives to do the grunt work. Like, is there some great, maybe it's gamified, I don't know. Is there is it, how can we tap into the grunt work that kids are willing to do to get the cool new item? Right, because they are doing that in the gaming worlds and in other places. I just don't think we have the right sort of environments and incentives. The only incentive right now is like you get paid, right? Like you get paid, and it's limiting, right? We don't have infinite money. We have to pay a market rate.
Chris, what you're saying is we should gamify the security team's job.
I think so. I mean, I did my example of someone gamified scam baiting and got a 13-year-old to scam bait for days on end, right? Like, I think there's potential there.
So if I could gamify my identity and access management configuration work?
Exactly.
So I mean, two observations that we have on this. I think, first of all, like in every industry, we always gravitate to the, like, the elite talent and think that is the proxy. Of course, it's always a problem. And actually, there are people who love doing jobs that you hate, you know, and that is about understanding the mindset and the psychographics of an individual and lining up that psychographic to the right task. And you know, look, as I'm building my company now, we psychographically analyze everyone, right? And Chris has been through this with our own selection of a CTO, where we psychographically analyze people so that we align what the kind of task that they love doing with the kind of task that need doing. So there are people who love doing the detailed, slow, repetitive work. But probably what we're doing is putting the people who want to do the really like intense stuff on the base stuff, and that doesn't work. So hopefully we can provide some insight on that, and that gives job opportunities to others who currently are not considering them. The second thing is we learn is if you do a grid analysis of career management, what happens is senior execs get really good career management from recruitment firms. So, but in the bottom of that grid analysis, i.e. entry-level talent, they get no career management. because recruitment firms are not interested in them, they're not worth enough money. The big organizations, everyone's cut down on their talent management function, so they don't get the career management stuff. Then imagine you're a neurodiverse, introverted cyber person. So you're not leaning in and asking for it either. So they get abandoned. And part of our Haptype product is to have an agentic career concierge, which goes, hey, Joe, you're 19. Your Haptype score is 45 out of 100. Go and do this course at Immersive Labs. Go and do this CTF with HackerOne. In your job, go and do 6 months doing the job, Vitaly, that you just described, or Joe, that you just described, because it'll increase your Haptype score. And give them the end mission, which is you're here to create a safer society and you've got a career pathway to do the really interesting stuff. But every time you do this base level stuff, it's enhancing your Haptype score, which enhances your employability. It goes back to the Kennedy conversation with the cleaner and NASA, right? What's your job? Well, I'm here to put someone on the moon. You know, if people have the top mission and they can understand why the grunt work is worth doing and they get rewarded for it, then you're gamifying their career progress so that they can persevere with the maybe not so interesting stuff to get to the stuff they want to do.
Well, speaking of exotic locations, that's where I met Fergus in Dubai. And we sat down and he told me what he's doing. And I was like, that's so cool. I like to learn more about it. And so this is a great opportunity to have him and Chris come to speak to us. I have a slightly different question. So recently there were a few high profile hacks in the UK, right? Yeah. Marks & Spencer and Harrods are both retail business, large retail businesses, and were both perpetrated by kids. Was that?
Yeah, by Scattered Spider, which is a subset, obviously, of the con. And the average age predicted of the perpetrators was 17 years old. Yeah.
And do these attacks help bring awareness and sort of demand to your platform, to what you're building?
Yeah, I like everything. When you put a headline in saying that a company lost $500 million to a cyber attack, it doesn't really mean anything to the average user. But if there are no apples on the shelf store in their local grocery, which is what happened in the UK, the food was not hitting the shelves in two of our biggest supermarkets, then people feel it. Now, one of those hit was the Co-op. The Co-op is an amazing business in the UK. It's a retailer, but it's a community organization, so it's non-profit. They have a Co-op store in every zip code in the country, even in the Outer Hebrides, where they know they will lose money on it. But their mission is to make sure food is affordable and accessible to all parts of society. And so when the Co-op doesn't have apples on the shelf, people feel it. Society feels it. And so I think it's a tipping point for the United Kingdom because people on the street, a bit like when the Sphere went blue because of the CrowdStrike, you know, the average person can identify with that. So it's definitely in the public discourse. And now what's interesting is people have gone on a journey. Shock that a retailer has been hit and people have lost money. But now there's understanding. So there's two great journalists in the UK, Mark Selman for The Times and Joe Tidy for the BBC. They have published reports and articles showing that it's Scattered Spider and it's teenagers. And actually, let's get into what the real problem here. The real problem isn't that the retailers lost money. That's unfortunate for them. The real problem is a social issue that it's young teenagers in the upstairs in people's bedrooms and their families that are doing the work. And there was a really interesting TV show that has now hit the US called Adolescence. And Adolescence is the most watched TV show on Netflix. I think you guys will, Joe, maybe you'll know that. I think it's had 95 million views in the opening few weeks. And it tells a story of a British kid. It's a fictional drama, four episodes, of a British kid who gets weaponized in his bedroom by the manosphere, the Andrew Tate culture, and ends up killing a girl. And it's shocking because it's like the average, nice, happy family, and it's that beautiful, smart kid who gets weaponized in their bedroom. And that has a really powerful impact on society because now people understand, oh my God, my kids are getting weaponized and recruited by cyber gangs in our nice bedrooms, in our Connecticut homes, and it can happen to us. And I think that is a really, really fundamental shift in the dialogue here in the UK. And it's one that once the public mass media like the Times and the BBC are publishing articles saying it's teenagers, you go from being a corporate issue to being a social issue. And that's when the tipping point is reached.
So interesting. And as you're working with young hackers from different geos, because I know you were, traveling to different places in the world, do you see differences in, hackers in the US versus hackers from the Middle East or Singapore, or are they very similar in terms of gaming mindset and, is there any cultural differences?
Yeah, I had exactly this conversation with Professor Jono Lusthaus, who's the author of The Human Impact of Cybercrime, and also Joe Tidy, who just published his book, Control Our Chaos. And the answer is no. I mean, Joe was just in Colorado interviewing a Ukrainian member of, not Lapsus, but the other one beginning with L. I'm afraid I've just forgotten it. Chris will remember. One of the big gangs. And he grew up in Russia. Actually, his entry point was exactly the same as all the others. Gaming, modding, cheating, working out how to make money, breaking stuff, stealing stuff, getting recruited. So actually, It's remarkably consistent. So I just haven't seen any anecdotal data yet from Gen Z that there are big variances. But, that may arise over time.
And the laws of different countries, do they serve as a hindrance to you, or do you have to deal with that as a challenge of working with teenagers in different countries?
It's not so much the laws yet. I mean, I'm in Europe, right? We're the most regulated kind of place in the planet. Actually, I don't find the law to be an impediment. At the moment, I find the governments and the law enforcement to be big enablers. They are very clear that they can go and arrest people who have done bad stuff, but what they want is us to stop them doing bad stuff before they get too bad on the illegal side. I think the interesting question there, Chengxi, is on security clearances. So, you can see that the expenditure on defense in every country is going up. The UK have just done their strategic defense review, $1.6 billion extra going into cyber immediately. Now up to 3% of GDP, people are taking a war footing, and that then demands different mindsets. And interestingly, we are hearing less concern about people's security backgrounds in order to staff up and equip for defense. So let's see how that plays out. But, the armed forces in the UK has a long history of taking troubled teenagers and giving them a pathway into the armed forces. And I think that it'll be very interesting to see if that will apply to the cyberspace. I hope it does, because, and I think Chris can attest to this, kids do stuff when they're young, and they do stuff that maybe they don't understand the impact of that. And Marcus Hutchins is a brilliant example of that. He saved the world with a WannaCry virus kill switch, but at the same time, he created a malware when he was 13 years old that was used for serious financial crime. But he is very clearly in the right path now. And he's an amazing asset to society. And I think we need to understand the journey that these kids go on and make sure that they're guided appropriately so that we can turn them into assets, not liabilities. But Chris, I mean, you had experience of that.
So Marcus is a great example, because the judge, when he was finally convicted, gave him basically, just time served, suspended sentence, because he had seen, since he had the bad behavior, he's done good things since then, right? And of course, the WannaCry stuff was one of the best things he did. So I think there is some understanding in the judicial system, but we need to help get the judicial system to understand that. I mean, part of this also is the CFAA needs to be reformed. There's been a lot of changes in technology where people are not malicious, who are just exploring, will get caught up in the malicious side of things. And yeah. So I think that's sort of how society can help here, is recognize if something is kind of a trivial thing. Like, you don't like if a kid shoplifted when they were 14, I don't think no one's going to hire them when they're 20, right? They're not going to be like, well, you shoplifted when you were 14, so you're obviously an ethical bad egg and we could never work here before. Like, we need to understand in cyber, it can be like that. Someone could have a misstep, but it doesn't mean they're an unethical person and shouldn't be, you know, employed. Yeah. So we need to fine tune that to the way things are today.
I want to double down on what you just said, Chris, because I've just seen that a million times. You know, so many of the cases that I've worked on with my teams have, when we've done the attribution, it's come back to being a neurodivergent team. And we always want, I mean, my Uber case, yeah, my team knew exactly who we were dealing with, and we wanted to help the kid. But law enforcement, you know, gave him a felony conviction, and none of us think that that was the right thing. And so we do have a lot to do to educate, you know, kind of all the different angles of looking at young people. The hard part is that the impact of shoplifting is small. You know, it's a Kit Kat. And yeah, in the case of, you know, a cyber situation, it can be a devastating impact to a corporation or to a bunch of people. So, that's the,
you know, Joe, I saw some interesting data. I think it came out of the FBI. So the repeat offender rate for someone who has gone to jail for a serious crime is 75%. The repeat offender rate for someone who's gone to jail for cybercrime is 20%. So what that shows you is that the moral code it's not decoded, right? You know, it shows you that the spread of the curve is wide enough to realize that actually just a lot of these kids are messing about. And I think we're at a really interesting era. It's the first era which is going to be led by this young generation, because technology is at the capability to match their levels of creativity and neurodivergence and ability. And they're going to have an outsized impact. So there's no history of any generation as young as this one that is going to have such a big impact, which means we need paradigm shifts. And that's paradigm shifts, to your point, is government and laws being understanding and reflecting. It's also the kids understanding the power that they're going to have, and with great power comes great responsibility. Pretty sure Disney wrote that. But then also, we need to communicate with them. And I think this is, you know, this is one of the things that we started with at the Hacking Games, is what is super clear to me is you cannot speak to these guys like a parent, like a teacher, like law enforcement, like a government. You cannot speak down to them. You cannot advertise to them. You have to communicate to them in the language that they understand. And that is, you know, popular culture and content and media and social media. So we've built this kind of four-tiered brand of the Hacking Games. It's a Gen Z brand where we have Gen Z content creators from gaming and ethical hacking creating TikTok and Snaps. We're doing the first ever esports ethical hacking format in November, which is their version of music festivals, right? That's what they gather around. 550 million kids watch esports a year. And then we've got content coming out with TV shows and documentaries of reality shows and scripted shows and fictional shows, all of it, so that when they're doom scrolling on their phones and they're watching Netflix and they're watching Amazon Prime, they're seeing popular culture saying ethical hacking is cool, man. Like, you want to be part of this. That's how you shift a generation's perception. If we don't create a culture around it, then it'll just be a bunch of middle-aged dads and mums trying to tell their kids to do the right thing, and it's not going to work, you know?
Maybe there will be a Netflix documentary in the future about the Hacking Games.
Well, listen, we've got 13 pieces of IP, so Netflix are welcome to work with us to make it. It'll be on one of the streaming platforms, so, you know, it should be on Netflix, really.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on and talk about this. I think from our standpoint, it's sparking ideas for me. I think the approach you're taking, we need to all start thinking about taking in other contexts as well in our organizations and with our team. So,
totally agree. Chris Fergus, thank you very much.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
Thanks, Changsi. Really appreciate it.